last week, we started with contemplating this idea that God brings evil regimes to an end, right? And thanking him for that, you know, considering how praiseworthy he is that he brings evil empires to an end, that he takes evil rulers off the throne, right? Daniel 5 teaches us very clearly that God is sovereign over the glory of earthly kingdoms. So when evil men try to seize God's glory, their days are numbered, right? So we saw that we moved from the first four chapters focused on Nebuchadnezzar as the king of Babylon, the Babylonian Empire that had seized God's people, Judah, and brought them into exile, which is why Daniel's there. We're now several kings later with Belshazzar. We looked at this, the first four verses, under the heading or under the idea of drinking from God's cup. Somebody tell me what is going on in those first four verses that make us title it that way. This is a softball. This is get you, you know. I'm just teeing it up. Hit it over the fence here. Millie?
Nebuchadnezzar had taken all of the golden vessels from the temple to Babylon and put them in the house of his God.
Okay, pause. I love that Millie gives us historical context before actually answering the question. Keep going.
Belshazzar knew this, but he took those vessels that were sacred.
Yep.
Dedicated to God only.
Yep.
And drank out of them.
Yeah, remember he's throwing a big party to show how awesome he was. And he's like, bring us the golden goblets, you know, or whatever, from our storehouse that we might drink wine and party and toast our own awesomeness from them, right? Yeah, Millie.
I think it also should be remembered that God said no person should touch the holy things of his tabernacle but the Levitical priesthood.
Right. Now, pagans wouldn't know that rule.
They wouldn't know it. But
nevertheless, right? God's truth is objectively true, not subjectively true, right? What do I mean by that? Somebody tell me what I mean by that.
Subjective means emotional.
Yeah, like to the person,
yeah.
Right? So we say like, there is one God and Father over all, right? We say something like that. That's not, you know, Karen doesn't get to interpret that the way she wants, and Josiah interpret that a different way, the way he wants. It's not my truth. Truth is truth. It's objective, right? So, yeah, that's right. Interestingly, verse 2, Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, you see that little phrase there? When he tasted the wine, commanded the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar's father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem to be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, his concubines might drink from them, right? That's the incident, right? But that little phrase, under the influence of wine, that little phrase, when he tasted the wine, probably references being under the influence of wine. In other words, he's already tasting it. He's already drinking it, right? So this, just to give you like sort of closer sort of vision of what kind of party this is. This is a drunken, let's celebrate me kind of party. Okay, so we looked at that. We looked at, drinking from God's cup. Well, these acts of hubris and idolatry would not go unanswered. As we turn to our next section, notice how verse 5 begins. Somebody read verse 5 for us.
Immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand.
That's good enough. So, wow, right? A human hand appears. Just the hand. A disembodied hand, is that what you'd call that? Separated from a body, right? Just a hand writing on the plaster of the... Look at how detailed this is. Fingers of a human hand appeared, wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. I mean, that's very specific, isn't it? And so what we get here is, notice that it starts immediately. This happened immediately after they drank from the cup of God's glory, if you will. This provides yet another connection with the sinful pride of Nebuchadnezzar, right, of taking the cups in the first place. All right, so now we move to this large middle section, verses 5 through 24, and we move from drinking from God's cup to deciphering God's message. Deciphering God's message. So while the king's face was probably flushed from wine, his color drains from his face when a human hand suddenly appeared writing a strange message in the light of his lampstand. You see it there in verse 6? Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. Friends, how quickly the foolish and blasphemous celebration of the proud can be brought to a screeching halt by God. Right? I mean, oftentimes we look at people in powerful positions that are evil, that are decidedly against God, and we're like, man, this person's invincible seemingly. But how quickly God can order things changed. I mean, all those who teach others that God had no part in creating our world, for example. Think about all the scientists of renown that have come out and pitched theories different than God creating the world. Or those smart people, those advanced people of study and from the academy that teach others that technological or medical breakthroughs are completely man's doing. Think about this now. At some point, and many of them are already there, whisked into eternity before the bar of God's judgment, silenced. All things are made plain, right? How quickly God can take the proud and chest-beating, look at me in my glory type situations and just whisk them away and change them. While Belshazzar and his rich friends saw themselves as invincible, a human hand passed through. Now, remember all that specificity? Passed through all of the city's protective walls. Remember, these walls were renowned for how thick they were. They were impenetrable. And the hand of God, right? No human impediment could keep him from it. Not only did this human hand pass through all of the city's protective walls and necessarily the king's military and even beyond that, his private guard, right? Notice that it's written on the inner wall of the palace, right there in the middle of the festivities. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of meetings and celebrations at what's Trump's place? Mar-a-Lago, right? Which is kind of like a White House, right? If you will, because it's the guy who's about to assume the presidency, and he has he has Secret Service protection, and it was already an exclusive place, not just anybody could wander in there and what have you. Can you imagine in the middle of like the New Year's Eve festivities? You know, all of a sudden, breaking through all of those protective layers, even in right into the room where all the somebodies are, God's hand presents itself. Think about that. Okay, so, but here's the next piece. While the confidence of the proud can be arrested, we see it here, right? His thoughts alarmed him, verse 6, right? While the confidence of the proud can be arrested, their sinful bent is amazingly resilient. even in the face of this hand presenting itself, right? Men do not easily let go of the cup of God's glory. Even when God clearly opposes them, they try to negotiate and maneuver the truth in order to continue to exalt themselves. Don't you see this when you talk to your friends who don't know Christ and try to explain the gospel to them? And they try to take the truth that you give them and try to manipulate it in such a way that they don't have to really deal with their pride and sin. I mean, this is just the way of the world. This is what we see in the king's unsuccessful attempt to manipulate a tolerable interpretation through his wise men, right? So in verses 7 and 8, he calls in, as we've seen this pattern over and over again, right? You know, God presents truth to the world, even presents his man to interpret, and the powerful guy turns to the wise people of this world. We see it yet again. And why is he turned to them? Because he wants a tolerable interpretation of what's going on. But then, so often, the course of these kinds of events, these pinnacle parts of redemptive history turn on one person. And the one person in our story that it turns on is the queen. The queen who has not been featured here. She's like, wait a minute, Daniel, right? She remembers. And it is in his audience with the king that we see the two ways to interpret the word of God emerge, right? The king's way is to avoid it by manipulating fortune tellers and local deities, while Daniel sees it as God's truth to be trusted and faithfully declared. I watched a movie that I certainly can't attest to its accuracy, but it was a movie that documented this this butler of some kind that worked in the White House over a really long stretch of time and saw presidents come and go in the White House. Well, Daniel was like that. He's now serving under his sixth Babylonian king. I mean, the youth that was taken from the promised land is now well into his 80s. But instead, so in case you were thinking like maybe it's time to retire from serving God, friends, right? Well into his 80s, right? He's a key figure in God's plans. Instead of seeing Daniel as a gift from God to interpret heavenly messages, that's been presented all the way since chapter 1, right? That little remark, that little throw-in, like, oh, God gave him the ability to interpret dreams. Remember that in chapter 1? And now we've seen Daniel interpret dreams all the way up until this point. Instead of the king seeing Daniel as a gift from God to interpret a heavenly message, and oh my goodness, we've just seen a human hand write one, right? The king treats him as a conquered slave, reminding him of his lowly status in the kingdom. Look there in verse 13. You are that, Daniel, what? One of the exiles of Judah, one of my conquered people. Right? And the king even tries to entice him to solve his problems by promising to exalt him from a mere slave to a person of wealth and influence in Babylon. How many times is Daniel going to be promoted and then forgotten? Right? But here it is, 16 promises it again. You shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. But Daniel knew the real score. He knew that Belshazzar and the Babylonian realm were short-lived. Taking the king's offer would have been like hearing the Titanic hit the iceberg and accepting an upgrade to a first-class cabin. Listen to Daniel's response there. You see it there in the second half of 17? Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Daniel then reveals three truths about the king's situation. First, he recounts the history of Nebuchadnezzar's foolish pride that resulted in God taking him off the throne, verses 18 through 21. Now, that judgment had been temporary. You remember? Verse 21, second half, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind, sets over it whom he will. Right? So remember, God had reduced Nebuchadnezzar to have the mind of an animal, right? Went crazy. And then, but later restored him. right? So that was a temporary judgment. And if we look back at the end of chapter 4, we see that Nebuchadnezzar seems to have realized this great truth, though how sincere he was is impossible to know. Recall his final words there, 437. I praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble. The point is not, did Nebuchadnezzar come to saving faith? That's not really the point. The point is that the pride, the prideful that try to steal God's glory are humbled. So that point is learned. So that truth is learned. That God is to be exalted, right? And men are to humble themselves before him. So that was the first part of what Daniel revealed to the king. The first is this idea of what has already taken place in Nebuchadnezzar. Second, Daniel boldly called the king out for knowing the truth and ignoring it. Look at verse 22 there. You, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, the God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways you have not honored. Well, that's just right up in his grill, isn't it? You knew this, and you sinned anyway. The world is in God's hands. Your breath is in his hands. He created the king, he set the king on the throne, and he judges those who dishonor him, as Nebuchadnezzar had, and Belshazzar knew all of this. You think that the great-grandson of Nebuchadnezzar didn't know that he went out of his mind for a period of time? Come on. He knew this, right? He also knew what the king had proclaimed, like the end of chapter 4, that God is to be exalted and men are to be humbled beneath him. Men know God exists and that he created them, but men deny this. They manipulate the truth. They ignore eternal wisdom. They try to escape from being accountable to God, right? I mean, this is what the king had done. It was what Daniel confronted him with. It's what the apostle wrote at the beginning of the letter to the Romans, right? Romans 1:18, men by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. They push it down. They try to cover it. They try to ignore it. They try to hide it behind them or whatever. For what can be known about God is plain to them, men, people who live in this world, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. That is, men are without excuse. Those who try to suppress the truth about the existence of God and their accountability to him, they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. This is always what sinful people need to be confronted with. The fact that you know there's a God and you're accountable to him. Stop acting as if you're not. Stop acting as if you're God. Right? This is the start of the gospel. This is the bad news part of the good news, right? So while the narrative doesn't spell out the fact that the king knew the handwriting was from God, Daniel states plainly that, like the voice from heaven to Nebuchadnezzar, the hand was from heaven. Verse 23, from God's presence the hand was sent, and this was inscribed. Okay. Well, finally, we turn to the last section of the narrative. We started with drinking from God's cup. And then inevitably that brought us to this frightful message from God, a message that had to be grappled with and deciphered, right? And now finally, we look to this third section, drinking from God's cup, deciphering God's message, and now dying under God's scales. Dying under God's scales, right? So that's verses 25 through 31. The words that this human hand inscribed in the wall, you see it in verse 25 there, mene, mene, tekel, and parson. I mean, that's really clear, isn't it? Of course it's not. It's written in a language we don't speak. It wasn't clear to the king. He was asking for people to help him decipher it, right? Well, thankfully, the Spirit of God deciphers it for us. It literally read, numbered, found wanting, and divided. Daniel provided the interpretation for the king. Look at verse 26 there. I'm going to kind of summarize 26 through 28 or take pieces of it. 26, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Numbered, found wanting, divided. I mean, this is huge. This isn't just the end of a particular king's reign. This is the end of an entire empire. An empire that had gone through all of these generations of kings that Daniel had been in service to, right? The end of Babylon, along with its final king and the final sort of group of important Babylonian people. The end of Babylon had been proclaimed. The vast empire would be divided and handed over to another world power. What's the reason? Because Belshazzar's claims had been tested. He had claimed to be the one responsible for the breadth and riches and might of the kingdom. He had claimed to be worthy of God's glory, worthy to drink from his cup. And in the perfect scales of God's judgment, quite predictably, the king had been found wanting. Well, let's weigh things. The perfect judgment of God. Who could be put in his scales, right? And been found, oh, that's just the kind, that's right, right at the level of my glory. Just the kind of person that ought to share my glory, right? Nobody can withstand that kind of weighing, right? And this is the picture, this is the metaphor, if you will, that is seen in these words. He had been found without power, without wisdom, without anything worthy of praise. The king, that is. He had been judged on the basis of himself apart from God, right? Nothing granted, nothing from God's account put in his account, just on his own merit, right? And he had been found wanting. Verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom. And because all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, the scales of God's judgment leads to death for everyone. That is just a universal truth. Without God breaking in, without mercy breaking in, right? Without the grace of God bringing faith and salvation, right? Men standing on their own, they're always found wanting. They always fall short of the glory of God. Their sin betrays them. The way they live their lives evidences what they believe, right? As Romans told us, right? They're without excuse, and so there's no excuse at the judgment. It's incredible when you think about it. This pattern just keeps repeating itself, right? And you and I are so easily, blinded by power and success of people in this world. Oh, I don't want to share the gospel with that person. He's got it all together. He's in a position, he's over me, you know? And he'll think I'm stupid, and he's obviously found a way to succeed. And we kind of do this in our minds, don't we? You ever been on a foreign mission trip? Anybody in the room? Gone somewhere outside of the States on a mission trip. I've visited a number of places, people that I know that maybe our church supported or whatever. I've been to Brazil to visit a missionary there. Ray Ronk spoke here one time. Do you remember Ray and Annette Ronk, church planners in Brazil? I went there. I was only a Christian short time. We had just been married just for maybe 6 months. And I went there. I've been to Costa Rica, where Cam Wolford, that we just started supporting, when he was actively church planting there. I've been to Russia to train young men for the pastorate and gone to a church there in Russia. And what I found is it's really easy to share the gospel with people in foreign places. They don't have anything over on me. Do you know what I mean? I'm likely never going to see them again. They don't hold any sway over me, right? The people that I witnessed to were relatively unimpressive people. For some reason, we've got this idea that when people are successful in this world, right? Like, they're just too big. They're, you know, and yet in the New Testament, over and over again, we're warned of this idea of partiality, aren't we? But at the foot of the cross, everybody is seen to be level. The playing field is level. Right? One author wrote this article that we use in premarital counseling, it's to try to get to the place to teach people who are about to be married and maybe who have rose-colored glasses on and don't think they're ever going to have, you know, knockdown, drag-out fights and have to ask one another for forgiveness and things like that. The writer of this article said, listen, most times, what gets in the way of reconciliation is that we think the other person, that it's all their problem. Like if they would just, I mean, clearly I'm in the right. If she would just see, you know, what error she's in right now or whatever, and the writer of this article was like, listen, the step one, if you want to reconcile, step one is knowing who you are. What kind of person you are. And if we're going to do that, then we need to have God's view on that. And God's judgment of each of us, of you, at the foot of the cross, is that you are so despicable of a sinner. You are so utterly rebellious and against God that he had to slaughter his perfect son to fix the thing. I mean, that's a level set, isn't it? And we need the gospel to inform us so that we don't like lift people up on pedestals and like, they've got a lot going for them. They don't need the good news too, or something like that. But we do. We let that get in our way. But if we think about this hand writing on the wall, isn't that memorable? If we can have that ingrained in our mind, that idea that, you know, everybody is numbered and found wanting and their kingdom will be divided and dispersed to other people after they're gone. They get to take nothing into the next life. If we think of it that way, that's really a helpful sort of memory peg to transform our way of thinking to see the great need that everybody has to hear the good news of Jesus Christ. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. The scales of God's judgment leads to death for everyone. And yet there is one who lived among us and didn't fall short of the glory of God. Because the Christ came, the Son of God, right? And took on human form so that he could live a life of perfectly glorifying God, never falling short, right? God weighed Jesus and didn't find him wanting. This is my son in whom I am what? Well pleased, right? And so everyone needs to hide themselves in him, to abandon this idea that they somehow have achieved something that approaches God's glory, right? Everyone in this world, all the sinners that have been born under the curse need to abandon that folly, that chalice clinking celebration that they're somebody. Right? And turn to the one who came to save. that God is pleased in. And Romans tells us, I love the logic of Romans 3. It's probably my favorite passage in the scriptures. You know, Romans 3 starts off and sort of proves the point that everyone has fallen short of the glory of God, right? Everyone's turned away. Everybody has evil on their lips, right? No one will be righteous by law keeping. That's the first half of Romans 3. No one will be declared righteous, right, by their works, by the works of the law. And then there's that turn in the middle, and he goes, ah, but there's a righteousness that comes apart from the law, though the law and the prophets bear witness to it. There is this righteousness that is yours through faith in Jesus Christ. Repent and trust in him, and his righteousness gets credited to your account, just as if you had never sinned, just as if you had never fallen short of the glory of God. Isn't that astounding? This chapter is so helpful in showing the need for that, the need for faith in Jesus Christ, because faith, even in the most powerful, successful person, isn't enough. It falls woefully short. Okay, that's it. I've come to an end. We've got a few minutes. You got any questions before we dismiss? Thoughts? Impressions? Testimonies?
I think at the playoff that the guy tries to score a touchdown, what do they do? They stick their chest
up. Yeah. Yeah. A pale reflection of what we do. Yeah.
But also, Daniel is a good example. He was very faithful speaking to God in his entire life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
In a very hard circumstance.
Yeah. A faith that's even credited to God, right? So, in other words, God gives us heroes of the faith to consider, not to worship, but to consider the outcome of their faith, right? And emulate their faith, right? So, yeah, and I think sometimes we who try hard to be Christ-centered, to have the gospel as the center, too quickly brush aside the idea of like heroes, the usefulness of heroes. They can certainly be misused, right? But they're super helpful in instructing us on how to believe in hard times. Yeah, that's a good point. Very good, Tom?
Yeah, the king, I mean, not that he forgot about what happened to his grandfather or whatever,
evaluation is it's always hinged to right now.
Yeah.
It's very short-sighted. You know?
Yeah, this won't happen to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, think of just the hubris of youth. I mean, I was a swimmer, and on the varsity swim team, the coach really beat into our heads this technique of diving shallow off the starting blocks, so you can come right up and get going, and you'll be faster than the guy next to you, right? And so I was so just full of pride, like how well I did that. I would dive off of my friend's garage into their 4-foot pool because I knew I could dive shallow. I'm not kidding you. I did it 100 times.
That is insane.
Isn't it? No, I'm just saying like, but that was... That assessment of myself was absolutely hinged to right now. Look at how, in shape and healthy and skillful and, whatever I am right now. You know, I tried that right now, like today, 30 whatever years later, you guys will be attending my funeral, but it's that self-evaluation is so foolish. Look at me right now, kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. Well, God bless you. You're dismissed.